Well, good morning. It is great having you at the Flint Central Church of the Nazarene, and there's no snow coming down from the sky, which is just kind of crazy. And today is the first Sunday in Lent, and so we're beginning our brand new sermon series called Objects from the Hill. And each week when you came in, hopefully when you came in today, you got a little sign. That's today's object. Each week we're going to be looking at a different object that would have been found on the hill, Golgotha, Calvary, where Jesus died. Because we Christians believe that the most significant event in the history of the world did not take place in the halls of Congress. The most significant event in the history of the world did not take place on a battlefield. The most significant event in the history of the world did not take place when Neil Armstrong took one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. No, the most significant event in the history of the world took place on a hill outside Jerusalem called Golgotha, Calvary. When you hear that word, Golgotha or Calvary, the Latin word is Calvary, when you hear that word, you think, well, that sounds like a nice place, kind of regal, Golgotha. Maybe there's, you know, flowers blooming and waving in the breeze. Not if it was Michigan, but no, you know, that sounds kind of nice. But Golgotha, the Bible tells us what it means, is the place of the skull. Now, you may have heard of a Calvary Church of the Nazarene or Calvary Baptist Church or something like that, but I don't think too many of us would go to a church that was called the Place of the Skull Church of the Nazarene. Almost sounds like it's a pirate church. Place of the Skull. Arr, come here. You know, we're told that, you know, we know skulls and crossbones are pirates, you know. We're told that when you see a skull and crossbone on a bottle, you know that's poison. You don't want to be anywhere near that. You want to be cautious with that. Stay away from that. But it was to the place of the skull that the soldiers led Jesus. It was on this place called Golgotha that Jesus died, the most significant event in the history of mankind. So over the course of the next several weeks, as we're marching our way to Easter, each week you'll get a different little object that would be found on that place. Today is a sign, next week a nail, one week a sponge and a dice and different things that you'll get just to remind you of what took place on that hill. It may mean that, you know, you'd take this little thing and put it in your purse or in your pocket or something, that you'll remember exactly what price was paid for your salvation. That's the whole point. So that you'll put these things, these little objects, you'll put them someplace around. And every time you see it, say, oh yeah, I remember. Jesus went to that place of the skull, the place that you should stay away from, the place that is dangerous. Jesus went there for me. It doesn't make a lot of sense, really, that the Messiah, the one we've been singing about today, would go to a place of the skull. In fact, it didn't make sense in the first century, and a lot of folks, it doesn't make sense today, when Paul was writing to the Corinthians. He said this, Jews demand miraculous signs, and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. But to those whom God has called both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. What Paul is saying here is that for the Jews, it just didn't make sense. Their idea of a Messiah was that he would sit on a throne and he would maybe do some miracles, but mostly he'd kick the Romans back to Rome. That he would be a military leader and everybody would know that the Messiah has come because he kicked the Romans back to Rome, got them out of the promised land. The Greeks, their understanding of a Messiah would be one that would be very wise and would dispense all sorts of wisdom and knowledge. And both of them thought there's no way that the Messiah would end up on a cross, a Roman cross. That doesn't make sense. Even the disciples had trouble grasping a hold of what it meant to be the Messiah. In fact, in Mark chapter 8, a great chapter in the Bible, Mark chapter 8, Jesus has just been through the first seven chapters of Mark. He's been performing all sorts of miracles. He's been healing hundreds, feeding thousands. Well, in Mark chapter 8, he starts, and most of those miracles were taking place in Galilee. Now, Mark chapter 8, he starts marching towards Jerusalem. And that march toward Jerusalem is leading one place to the cross, the place of the skull. And the disciples, they understand Jesus is at the height of his popularity. The opposition is located in Jerusalem. But Jesus is going to Jerusalem. So he looks at the disciples one day, and he, as they're getting ready to go, and he says, listen, fellas, who do people say that I am? And the disciples said, well, it's interesting that you should ask that, Jesus, because we've been taking some polls and a little bit of surveys, and this is what we found. About 15% of the people think that you're John the Baptist. Which is a little weird, quite frankly, because John the Baptist and you are contemporaries, and he was your cousin, and now he's dead. Why they think you're John the Baptist, that's beyond me. But 15% think you're John the Baptist. And about 25% think you're another prophet. But Jesus, I think you're going to like this. A lot of people think that you're Elijah. He's one of the greatest prophets of all time. And a lot of people think that you're Elijah. And Jesus said, well, all right, that's great. But fellas, who do you say that I am? And Peter was the one. He just blurted it out there quicker than he could even think it. Mark chapter 8, verse 29, he said, you are the Christ. And the idea is all the other disciples agreed with him. It's like, all right, Petey, good answer. High fives all around. Jesus is the Christ. Woo! But see, they're still thinking of what the Christ means. They're still thinking he's going to sit on a throne and kick the Romans out, and he's going to rule and maybe do a few miracles. That's what the Christ means. But Jesus then goes on to tell them exactly what the Christ means. And he said, he began to teach them, Mark chapter 8, verse 31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this. So the Messiah was going to be rejected and suffer and killed after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly. It's just, this is what's going to happen, boys. Boom. And again, Peter, quick to jump up. Remember, Peter had just said, you're the Messiah. You're the Christ. You're the Son of God. So you would think that if Peter had said all those things, you would think he'd agree with anything that Jesus said, right? If you just said to somebody, you're the Son of God, you would think they would know what they're talking about. But listen to what happens next. Peter took him aside, took Jesus aside, and began to rebuke him. Time out, Jesus. You don't understand. That's not what Messiahs happen. Messiahs aren't rejected. Messiahs don't suffer. Messiahs go to Rome. They kick the Romans out of Rome. Messiahs maybe give a piece of their mind to the Pharisees who've been on our back for the last 3 years. Messiahs do not suffer. They do not go through all that. And for lastly, Messiahs do not die. And Mark tells us what happens next. But when Jesus turned and looked at these disciples, he rebuked Peter. And he said, get behind me, Satan. And in case you're wondering, that was not a compliment. In fact, you know, Peter was one of Jesus' closest friends. He was one of the inner circle. Jesus called him the thing that was the harshest thing Jesus could have called him. All the things he could have called him. Peter, you dummy. Peter, you whatever. Instead, he said, get behind me, Satan. Get behind me, you who do not have in mind the things of God. Because then he went on and said, you don't have the things of God in mind, but rather the things of men. Your idea of Messiah and my idea of a Messiah are miles apart. My idea of a Messiah means that I'm going to suffer and I'm going to die and I'm going to go to a cross. That's what my idea of a Messiah is. And Paul, trying to communicate that, said it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense to the disciples. Didn't make sense to the Jews. Didn't make sense to the Gentiles. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. It means God knows what he's doing. And what he was doing was sending his own son to a cross for you and me. So over the course of the next several weeks, we're going to be looking at that place of the skull, that place of death. Some Bible scholars think it was called the place of the skull because it was shaped like a big old skull. Some people think it was called the place of the skull because that's where that place of death was. And there were skulls all around because it was the executioner's hill. For whatever reason, that's where Jesus went. So we're going to look at that. We're going to examine it. We're going to look at it through the lens of these objects. Today, we're talking about the sign. It wouldn't have been very surprising for people to see somebody crucified in the first century. Crucifixions were the Roman way. It was a way to intimidate and humiliate the people. And so there were crucifixions all the time. People were constantly being crucified. If they disrupted the civil order, the Roman way, then they would hang them on a cross. So it wouldn't have been too surprising, even though it's so inhumane and we look at that and it's so gruesome and terrible and horrible death, and it certainly was. So that Jesus died on a cross would not have been all that strange. What was strange about the place where Jesus died on that hill was that sign that was hanging above his head. All four gospels tell us that there was a sign hanging above Jesus' head. It's interesting, just to put it in perspective, only two Gospels tell that Jesus about the birth narrative and tell about how Jesus was born. Only two. Just Matthew and Luke. Only the Gospel of John tells us about Lazarus being raised from the dead. Only the Gospel of Luke tells us about the prodigal son. But all four Gospels tell us that there was a sign hanging above Jesus' head. It seems to me that that would indicate that that sign is somewhat significant, that we ought to look at it and see what God is trying to communicate through this sign that was placed above Jesus' head. And so that's what we're going to be focused on today, that those words that Pilate, of all people, wrote out and had placed on that cross above Jesus' head. And in a story, you might feel a little sorry almost for Pilate, as you know, may know, was the Roman governor. Pilate was kind of a big fish in a little pond. Judea would not have been the prime destination for a guy trying to make his way up the Roman system, but that's where Pilate was sent. And so his job really was just to keep peace, keep Rome happy. That was what it was. So if you kept the peace, kept the people down, kept them oppressed as much as you can, kept the tax revenues flowing to Rome, then he was doing his job and maybe he could get out of Judea and on to a nicer place. That was Pilate's whole intention. That was Pilate's whole agenda. So you almost feel a little sorry for him when they bring before him this guy, Jesus of Nazareth. What are you going to do with Jesus of Nazareth? It didn't take him long to figure it out. He did not do anything worthy of a capital offense. He did not deserve the death penalty. And yet, these chief priests and leaders, they all wanted Jesus dead, 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 dead. So what's a Roman governor supposed to do? So he looked over at Jesus and said, I know what I'll do. I'll get him to defend himself, and then they'll see that he really didn't do anything that's worthy of death. And so he tried to get Jesus to defend himself, but we all know that didn't work. Jesus didn't defend himself. Said, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll appease the intellectuals in the crowd, and I'll get him to talk about philosophy. And so he asked Jesus, what's the truth? But again, that didn't work. Jesus didn't answer that question. So he thought, I know what I'll do. I'll get the crowd on my side, and I'll bring out the worst criminal I can think of, that sociopath Barabbas. I'll bring them out and say, I'll give you either one or the other. You decide. No one in their right mind would choose Barabbas. He's a terrorist. He's terrible. No one would pick Barabbas over Jesus. But we know that didn't work. So he thought, I know what I'll do. I'll just beat him to a pulp. I'll beat him to an inch within his life. And then when I do that, the people who are mad at Jesus will see that really he didn't even do anything to deserve that. And so they surely won't say, let's kill him anyway. But of course, we know that didn't work. And so Pilate decided to just wash his hands of the whole matter and say, well, everyone's going to forget about this Jesus after he's dead anyway. Well, thanks be to God, that didn't work either. So Pilate has this sign made. And John tells us exactly how that all went down, and this is how John describes that whole scene. Pilate handed him over to be crucified. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus, carrying his own cross. He went to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. Here they crucified him with two others, one on each side, Jesus in the middle. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened to the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Many of the Jews read this sign, the place where Jesus was crucified, near the city, and the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but rather this man claimed to be the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I've written, I have written. Now, there's plenty of questions regarding this sign. You know, why did Pilate have the sign made in the first place? Why did he have it written in three different languages? Why were the Jewish leaders so upset that he said that he was the King of the Jews? Why do all four Gospels, as we mentioned, why do all four Gospels include this in their story of Jesus? What's the big deal and the point of the sign? That's what we're tackling. Because, see, I believe that the sign does tell us a few things about God and his great love. And the thing that it tells us most obviously is that God will use anything to get his message out of his great love for you and me. He'll even use a sign placed there by a pagan Roman governor. He'll use anything to get his message out. And the good news is that that sign bore a results almost immediately. Luke tells us in his story of the crucifixion that Pilate had the sign placed on there. And in verse 23, verse 38, Luke says, at the top of the cross were these words written, this is the King of the Jews. And then just four verses later, just four short verses, the thief, one of those guys hanging on the either side of Jesus, said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. It's very interesting that he would say it that way. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. See, he didn't say, Jesus, save me. That would have meant that he thought Jesus was the Savior. And he didn't say, Lord, have mercy on me. That would have indicated that he thought Jesus was the Lord. He said, remember me when you come into your kingdom. That's a servant talking to a king. Where did he get that notion? Now, maybe he had heard Jesus preach. Jesus talked about the kingdom of God a lot. In fact, 111 times in the Gospels, Jesus refers to the kingdom of God. So maybe this thief heard Jesus preach sometime. Could be. Or maybe as he was hanging on the cross, he just looked over and saw that sign. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. That seems to make the most sense to me. He just looked over, here's the King of the Jews. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And I love that whole story because Jesus says to him in so many words, I'll do better than that. You're going to be with me in paradise today. That may have been the first thing that God used, that sign, to communicate the message of the cross, but it certainly wasn't the last. God uses lots of things to communicate his great love. He uses, well, the printing press. He used the printing press. Some say that it was the printing press as much as Martin Luther that led to the Reformation. And God uses TV and radio and internet today to proclaim his message. God uses lots of, God uses church softball. I've seen guys find the Lord because of church softball. Sometimes the devil uses church softball too, but I've been around some of those games too, let me tell you. God uses that. God uses marathons to raise money for people that don't have clean drinking water. God uses anything. God uses tomorrow night. This sanctuary is going to be filled with parents from the Upwards thing. God uses Upwards and basketball, and God uses anything to communicate his great love. God uses, you know, we're going to have that wild game dinner here a couple of weeks for the men's ministry. Next week is the men's prayer breakfast. God uses things like that. God uses anything. A couple churches ago, we had a church sign like what we have out front, you know, with the removable letters. So we'd put up signs. And I always, pet peeve of mine is churches that put, you know, just dopey things on their church signs. You know what I'm talking about. You know, we have better Sundays than Baskin Robbins. That's so dumb. You know, CH blank blank CH. What's missing? You are. And I always think if I was a non-Christian driving by that church, I'd say, I do not want to go there. They're so weird. They think that's funny. It's just dumb. Don't. So we were at this church. We had a sign like that one. You know, we didn't have Stephen Curtis Chapman coming, so we just had to, you know, put whatever was coming up at the church. Well, it's time between, you know, Easter and vacation Bible school. So what do you put on the sign? I don't know. So the guy goes, you got to put something on. Can't have the sign empty. I don't know. So I said, all right, let's put on. If you're an old Nazarene like me, then you remember way back in the day, the old slogan for the Church of the Nazarene was, our church can be your home. Remember that? That's dumb. And so it's kind of a dumb saying. And the guy said, what do you want to put? I said, oh, put that old dumb saying on there. Our church can be your home. So that's what we put on the sign. And I was just, you know, I thought it was corny and dumb and idiotic, but we put it on there. Well, this lady, she was driving by. She didn't know. She didn't know that that was a dumb slogan. She didn't know that the Church of the Nazarene had had that for, you know, a million years. She didn't know all that. She just thought it was clever. Our church can be your home. She drove by it every week. Our church can be your home. And eventually she went to her daughter. She said, you know what? We're going to go to church. Daughter said, what church? We're going to go to that church down the road. That church can be our home. So she came. She liked it. She came a few weeks and she went home, back home, got her husband and their son. They all started coming. Eventually, they all found Jesus. And what happened? It was all because of a dumb sign that I didn't even want to put out there. Our church can be your home. Point is, God uses anything God can use to communicate his great love for us. This story tells us, too, not just that God uses anything, a sign. God uses anyone. Who put that sign on the cross? It was a Roman pagan governor, Pontius Pilate. God used anyone. Now, Bible scholars will say that Pontius Pilate didn't try to communicate the gospel through that Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And that's probably right. Maybe what Pilate was saying was, this is what happens to your king. Your people are so messed up, we crucify kings here. That's what we do. That's the Roman way. Maybe that's what he was trying to communicate. But the truth is that God used old Pilate. He didn't know it, but God used old Pilate, and there was at least one convert, that thief on the cross. God uses anyone, to communicate his great love. You've probably heard this old story. I don't know if it's true or not, probably not. This lady, old lady, saintly lady, but poor as a church mouse. Didn't have anything. And next to her was a guy who liked her because she was a sweet old lady, but he didn't believe in God. He was an atheist. Didn't believe. So he thought he could kill two birds with one stone. So one day he went to the grocery store, bought all sorts of groceries, put it on her porch, rang the doorbell, got out before she could get there. And the lady came out, and of course she responded the way he knew she would. She was praising Jesus for these groceries. She was so thankful. She was like the lady we looked at a couple weeks ago, you know, that had the coin, and she started telling her neighbors. Well, that's what this lady did. She started telling all of her neighbors, look what Jesus did. Look how he provided. I didn't have any groceries, and Jesus provided the groceries. And that guy, you know, he had had it. He had heard it, and he said, I knew it. I knew you were going to thank Jesus for those groceries. Jesus didn't have one thing to do with it. He said, I went to the store. I bought those groceries. I put them on your porch. I rang your doorbell. I got out of there. Those groceries are there because of me. And that dear old saintly lady said, oh, honey, Jesus provided those groceries. I didn't know he was going to use the devil's money, but Jesus provided the groceries. Point is, God uses anything. God uses anybody to communicate his message. And God will speak any language. That sign was written in three languages, Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. Aramaic, the language of the common folks just walking by, that's the language they spoke. They'd look up there, see the sign, Jesus Nazareth, King of the Jews. Latin, the language of the Roman authorities. Latin, the language of the soldiers. Latin, the language of the Roman centurion. He'd look up there, that sign, Jesus Nazareth, King of the Jews. Greek, the language of Greece, but also the language of learning and culture. Anyone cultured or learned who walked by there, Jesus, King of the Jews. Three different languages, the message was the same. Jesus is the King of the Jews. Jesus will use any language to get and communicate his message to you. And I'm not talking about Latin or Aramaic or Greece. I'm saying that he'll speak to you in the language of everyday life to communicate that he loves you. Now, sometimes that language is a language of blessing. And sometimes God blesses us. And we have, you know, the cupboards are full and life is great and things are going on. Don't be so arrogant. Don't be so proud. Don't be so naive to think that the things you have are not from God. He is the giver of every good and perfect gift. And he is the one that bestows upon those things. And sometimes God speaks to us through blessing. And the message is clear. I love you so much, but use those blessings for my glory. I didn't give them to you so you can hoard it or bury it. I gave it to you so that you could use it for my glory. So sometimes God speaks through that. Sometimes God speaks through want. We don't have two dimes to rub together. And sometimes God gets our attention when we're struggling financially, when we're struggling with life. And sometimes God speaks through want. Now, of course, we'd rather he speaks through blessing than through want. But sometimes that's how God gets our attention, and he speaks through that. Sometimes God speaks through affliction and turmoil. My goodness, I literally wrote the book on that, Chronic Pain. There's your shameless plug. You know, he can speak to us. He gets our attention sometimes when we deal with physical ailments or when we deal with just the junk of life. Sometimes God can speak to us through there. I've seen God speak through tragedy. I've had people come to know the Lord through funeral services. When I've been preaching and talking about heaven and hell, and those folks are sitting there and watching that casket up in front and saying, one day that's going to be me, and do I know where my eternal destiny is going to be? And sometimes God speaks through tragedy. The point is God speaks, God speaks, God speaks. Are you listening? And here, if you don't hear this, if you've been asleep because you missed an hour, listen to this. This is what you need to really hear. What's God saying? I can tell you exactly what. God is not mad at you. God loves you. He's mad about you. And he's crazy in love with you. And he wants you to hear that message. And he'll speak that message. And the question is, are you listening? Back in my days when I was a Bad Axe pastor, I pastored the Church of the Nazarene in Bad Axe, Michigan. You have to be careful how you say it. But when I was there in Bad Axe, pastoring the church, I did, Andy. I pastored Bad Axe, Michigan, Church of the Nazarene. I was the Bad Axe pastor. No, stop that. There was a guy. His name was Ron. Ron came to church. He wasn't even Christmas and Easter. I was there for 3 years, and so for the first 2.5 years, Ron came a couple times. Once in a blue moon, Ron came to church. And it just so happened, Ron had lived a rough life. He'd been in and out of jail and made a lot of bad choices, had a lot of bad habits and hang-ups. He would have been a perfect candidate for Celebrate Recovery. But he just, you know, once a blue moon, Ron would show up. Every single time, it was like three times. Every time, though, Ron came in that 2.5 years, I preached a basic gospel message. You know, nothing too hard to understand. Just, you know, you need to give your heart over to Jesus. It wasn't like I saw Ron come and said, oh, I got to get out the Ron sermon. I didn't do that. It's just he happened to be there on the Sunday, and I was preaching a basic, you got to give your heart over to Jesus sermon. Well, after the third time that week, later that week, Ron showed up at my house. It wasn't hard to find my house. The Bad Axe Parsonage was right next door. In fact, they were connected underground to the Bad Axe Church. And so, you know, he knew exactly where we lived. So Ron showed up at my door. And he said, preacher, we're standing out on my steps. Preacher, how come every time I come to your church, you preach a sermon about how I need to give my heart over to Jesus? Do you see me coming? I said, no, Ron, I don't see, you know, it's just where I'm at. So how come every single time that I show up to your church, you're preaching that same message? I said, well, Ron, maybe God is trying to tell you something. Maybe that's what's going on here. He said, do you really think that is what's happening? I said, yes, Ron, I really do. I think if every time you show up at church and I'm not planning you're going to be there, you don't tell me, you don't give me a call and say, well, you're coming, you just show up. And every time you show up, that's the sermon. Maybe God's trying to say something to you. And the question is, are you listening? And right there on my steps on 131 Hubbard Street in Bad Axe, Michigan, Ron gave his heart to Jesus. And maybe I need to start listening to what Jesus has to say. Then Ron didn't miss. See, the point is, God will use anything to communicate his message. He used a sign. Now, these little scroll signs that we handed out today, they're not like fortune cookies. You know, it's not, you know, they're not specific for you. Don't take them out and, you know, think, oh, this is. The point is, some of them say different things. If you're in an impossible situation, God works in impossible situations. If you're burdened down, God says, bring your burdens to me. If you've been running away from God, one of them has, you know, Luke 15, wherever you've been, wherever you've done, come back. Prodigal son. There's a lot of different, the point is God loves you. He'll try anything to communicate that message to you. He'll use anybody to communicate that message to you. Sometimes he speaks in times of want. Sometimes he speaks in times of blessing. Sometimes he speaks in times of struggle. But the point is, he's always speaking. Are you listening? Are you listening? Are you listening? That's the point.